In my parish church this year, the guest speaker giving the Easter sermon began with Lazarus, not St. John's account, but David Bowie's pop video, after which he explained he's come to the conclusion Easter's message and Christianity's principal point is affirming resurrection of the body, something he assured us the Bible talks about repeatedly. Maybe you assume so too, although I hope you won't in a few minutes from now. Since that speaker is a friend of mine, who enjoys a reputation in certain circles, his sermon was disappointing. A little bit, because Bowie's video is simply a sub-Christian. Much more so, because my friend's two principal assertions, ones we'll examine tonight, depart from the theological mainstream. And also, because when we'd met a month earlier and he'd said something similar, I challenged my friend, amiably, by offering a pint for every time resurrection of the body is mentioned in the New Testament. And I'll make you the same offer. Of course, you'll find anastasis, the Greek word for resurrection, some 40 times. 14 refer to the resurrection of mankind. 11 to the resurrection of the dead, 2 more to resurrection from the dead, 8 to Jesus' resurrection specifically. Then there are single mentions of resurrection of the just, also of the just and unjust, of resurrection of life, also of resurrection of judgment, and finally, the book of Revelation speaks of the first resurrection. Sorry to be statistical, but we need to be clear. Nowhere in the New Testament will you find resurrection of the body. The expression is never used, not once. Nevertheless, it is enshrined in the Apostles' Creed. Or is it? In fact, the term first appeared only in Tudor times, in a 1543 work usually called the King's Book, since it was authorised by Henry VIII, who also wrote its preface. What the creed itself says, in the original languages, is Anastasis Sarkis in Greek, or in Latin, Resurrectio Carnis. And instead of being translated resurrection of the body, it ought to be resurrection of the flesh. I'm not splitting hairs. The distinction is significant. Body in the New Testament is a quite neutral term, whereas flesh definitely isn't. Were we in English to say resurrection of the carnal, that would give you a clue as to the difference. Flesh, especially when St. Paul used the word, is what sinfulness makes of us, not just weakness in the human condition. Flesh is the sphere of sin, of persons wrongly directed. Isn't that surprising, shocking even? Traditionally, in baptism, flesh is what Christians renounce along with the world and the devil. It's precisely what we abjure, which, according to the creed, will be resurrected. Yet the New Testament warns the flesh profits nothing. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom. So this flesh being raised to stand upright, which is the root meaning of resurrection, must be new flesh, redeemed, born again. It needs to be, as it were, flesh, with the flesh taken out, spiritualized flesh. Sadly, my friend never suggested resurrection of the body is more than simple survival, our present physical bodies being revived, like Lazarus's, which is an essentially mundane hope. And that's the first way he departed from normal theology. Most ordinary Christians picture the afterlife as heavenly, and if pressed, will say that means it's spiritual. Most scholars think so too, as do I. But my friend insists it's surviving in a physical body such as we have now. Honestly, though, is that plausible? When these bodies are subject to change, damage, decay, and finally death. No need to get too close to notice mine's gone a little way down that road already. Actually, we face simple alternative. Either our bodies must be altered so completely we can no longer consider them physical, or else we'll die again, as Lazarus did. Surely the first alternative is the correct Christian view. St. Paul taught we'll change from this mortal state, and our futures will be in imperishable, celestial, spiritual bodies, to which present ones relate no more than dying seeds due to the plants that grow from them. Jesus himself said, we'll be like angels. That I therefore regard as binding. As to its implications, Christians may legitimately differ. And what I'm about to say does involve speculation. Any discussion of afterlife does. My friend's materialistic view, or atheist denials do, just as much as mine. Like angels, yes, but not precisely the same. They're reckoned pure spirits, capable of acting in our world, but neither part of it nor is it part of them. However, for us, it's where our identity is forged. So wouldn't becoming pure spirits forfeit and devalue our physical experiences, impoverish us, even undermine our identity? Were that so, then it's understandable if people want to hang on to the physical. Yet that can still happen. Angelic spirits know the world only indirectly, as it were externally, whereas our spirits, since they're embodied now, know it directly. It imprints on our spirits internally. So, even when we leave these bodies behind, still, all the world we've known, all its sensations, situations, insights, relationships, are retained, taken up with our spirits into the next world. Or not so much taken up with our spirits as within our spirits. C.S. Lewis put it like this appropriately in the last couple of pages he ever published. Our souls now seem to be within our bodies. Perhaps hereafter, our bodies will be within our souls. My friend would complain that's too abstract, not concrete enough. Too Greek, not Hebrew enough, is how he'd put it. But that disregards, or maybe it's unaware, how often those traditions overlapped. Jesus's contemporary, Philo Judaeus, thought resurrection of the body is only a metaphor for immortality of the soul. Moses Maimonides, the great compiler of Jewish principles, expounded resurrection of the body entirely in terms of immortality of the soul. Reform synagogues, in their teaching and liturgy, have dropped resurrection of the body entirely in favor of immortality of the soul. Next time I bump into my friend, instead of offering a pint, perhaps I should tell him straight. Stress the physical, and we'll not get resurrection of the body, only the temporary reanimation of a corpse. Stress the spiritual, and in a real sense, we'll retain the physical too. Yet I confess, one verse, taken at face value and in isolation, scuppers my case. Just before the end of Luke's gospel, the risen Christ reassures the disciples that he's not a ghost by eating fish and inviting them to see and handle him. The passage is clearly a brief conflation of two or three separate incidents recounted more fully by John, who was himself present, unlike Luke. The problem is, Luke has the risen Christ describe himself as having flesh and blood. Yet John's eyewitness account says nothing of the sort. Moreover, those words are at odds with the New Testament's always elsewhere, indicating the afterlife will be in a quite different state to what we're in now. I can only conclude that either Luke's source supplied those words, or very possibly an early copyist did, for there are manuscript variations at that place in the text. Supplying those words, I'm sure, was well-intentioned, seeking to clarify that Jesus hadn't returned as something subhuman. Unfortunately, the form of words, if taken literally, suggests he only resumed being human, whereas all the rest of the New Testament tells us he was significantly more, as we'll see, returning now to the general issue of resurrection. My friend's first mistake is supposing that it's physical survival. The second is reckoning resurrection is the most important thing. By contrast, in the creeds, it's both more and less. More than survival, but less than central. Because the creeds recognize it results from something bigger. There, as the word flesh indicates, resurrection is a function of redemption. Redemption is more central and determinative. But on what basis did the creeds decide that? You'll recall my list showed resurrection of the flesh isn't a New Testament term any more than resurrection of the body is. Actually, the biblical material stresses something yet more central and determinative, more than either resurrection or redemption. Bear in mind two questions I'll leave in the air, to be answered as we go along. First, has it struck you, unlike my friend, how uninterested the Bible is in survival, in those returned from the dead, apart from Jesus himself? Admittedly, there is a later story that the Jews put Lazarus and his sisters to sea in a leaky boat, yet miraculously they made it to Cyprus where he became bishop. Probably it's just a pious fable. What's certain is that New Testament writers took no further interest in him, nor Jairus's daughter, nor the widow of Nain's son. Why ever not? There's someone back from the dead. What's so important as makes that unimportant? Eclipses that entirely? That's the first question to bear in mind. Second, recall Paul, charged by the Jews with being a pestilent fellow, on trial before Felix, the governor who ducked delivering a verdict, perhaps baffled by Paul's defense. I'm in the dock for believing in resurrection, as do most of my accusers. The confusion, of course, came from the words meaning very different things to each side. Now, Jews are people, they'll not mind me saying this, well used to disagreeing amongst themselves and almost making a virtue of it. So why wasn't Paul's Christian understanding of resurrection, why wasn't it a tolerable variation? What made it intolerable? That's the second question to bear in mind. Just what did Jews then believe, and why? As I implied, there wasn't a consensus. A minority didn't accept it at all, and those who did disagreed. Who would be resurrected? Righteous Jews? Righteous and unrighteous Jews? Or all men, including women? Where would they be resurrected? On earth? On a transformed earth? In paradise? What form would it take? Our present bodies revived? Or transformed bodies? or not in bodies at all, at least not physical bodies. Opinions spread right across the spectrum. Three features, though, were universally agreed by those Jews who did believe in afterlife. Firstly, resurrection had to be brought about by God. It had not occurred naturally without miraculous intervention. Secondly, it had occurred at some future date, which would also mark the end of the age, the end of the world. And thirdly, whether involving all or only some of mankind, it would be a separation, finally, of good from evil. It would be accompanied, or would constitute, final judgment. And why had many Jews of Jesus' time come to believe this? Old Testament Jews anticipated only an unappealing lingering of subhuman shades in subterranean Sheol. Ezekiel's vision of dry bones reassembling was about the nation regathering, not the fate of individuals after death. A verse in Job does suggest that, but it's more a yearning than a statement of belief. In Psalms, a couple of verses and a passage in Isaiah are also suggestive, but their poetic language makes precise interpretation difficult. The first clear statement of resurrection, written right at the end of the Old Testament period, is in Daniel. Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to reproaches and everlasting abhorrence. Yet, large as those scattered few verses loom in retrospect, the fact is they had no appreciable impact on Jewish thinking at the time. Only later, in the intertestamental period, did the belief begin to take hold. During the Maccabean revolt, the large numbers martyred engendered a feeling it would be fitting, appropriate, it would be just for God to reward their self-sacrifice with an afterlife more substantial than Sheol. On the basis of such theorizing grew the hope of resurrection. Now, consider the contrast. Lazarus called out of the grave wasn't pious conjecture. Instead, it's witnessed as fact. Nor was it in the future. Instead, it's the end of the world, a new age breaking into the here and now. Nor was it reward or recompense for the sacrifices of righteousness. Instead, it's given by one whose love was evident in his weeping for the dead. Nor was it vindication of the rescued. Instead, it vindicates the rescuer who had seemingly abandoned the man to die. Nor was it final judgment on us men. Instead, it demands we pass our judgment on the one who quickens the dead. That's what eclipses interest in Lazarus. Other questions, other answers pale before a single overwhelming issue. Who can do this? Re-quicken a man whose Hebrew name, Eleazar, happens to mean God is my help. In Martha's responses, there's escalating recognition. Bereaved, probably tempted to feel betrayed. Nonetheless, she goes on trusting. And the heartbreaking delay, which meant Lazarus wasn't healed, nevertheless serves to display the glory of God as it leads to something greater and more revelatory than just healing. The man her family previously called Rabbi, she now addresses as Lord, Christ, Son of God. The same escalating recognition is acted out a few days later when her sister Mary anoints Jesus. For anointed is what the Hebrew Messiah and the Greek Christos mean. Always, resurrection was spoken of, it could only be spoken of, in the passive, resurrection of men, men will be raised up. Always passive, till Jesus started saying the unsayable, I will raise up. Now, at Bethany, he proves he is the agent of resurrection. And more, he is the source of resurrection. And more, he constitutes resurrection. I am the resurrection and the life. Consequently, whoever believes in me. Prominent members of the Jewish establishment passed a very different judgment. After all, how tolerable or how intolerable is it for leaders of an aspiring theocracy when someone acts as only God can? Caiaphas, high priest of the Sadducee faction, which refused to believe in resurrection, cowed the council into judging it expedient to kill the rescuer. Thus, events at Lazarus's tomb would have been enough to explain why the sides arguing before Felix were at cross purposes. But the pestilent fellow Paul looked beyond Bethany to Golgotha. Not that the places were unconnected. From the outset, Thomas foresaw Jesus' going to the dead and putrefying man would cost Jesus his life. Yet Thomas wryly resolved to follow anyway, even if his own life would be at risk too. Jesus, of course, knew what was going to happen. When Mary anoints him, he discloses, "It's for my burial." Restoring believers' lives at his cost, through his sacrifice, is precisely what redemption means. It's its key pattern. So now, finally, we've pinpointed what the biblical material actually stresses, that resurrection and redemption both are functions of our relationship with Jesus. That is the most, the truly central determinative thing. Paul looked beyond Bethany and Golgotha, beyond the empty tomb too. Paul looked to the risen Christ himself, not to a place or event, but to a person, in response to whom Paul found and forged his true identity. And in common with all Christian believers, he discovered the only apt response to that person is worship. For Jesus' resurrection, unlike any other, wasn't a return to ordinary life. It revealed him both transformed and transforming, risen and then ascended, taking humanity up to God the Father. Jesus thereby intercedes eternally for us. So his overcoming death brings victory over sin as well. Our flesh is forgiven. And we learn the marvelous truth that what's been bad can become, like Lazarus' death, like Jesus' death, roots to a greater good. Already, in now having unimpeded access to God, we experience ourselves redeemed, which allows us to begin seeing our past, whatever its faults and flaws, was a path towards God's love. Presently, of course, we can make that out only partially. Enough, though, to trust confidently that creation is starting to stand upright, and finally, it will transpire that all things have been worked together by God for good to those who believe. Meanwhile, Christ sends the Holy Spirit to live in conjunction with us, confirming our calling to be veritable children of God, strengthening us through the means of grace and the hope of glory. Only it's more than hope. Already, Jesus is bringing us into new life, more abundant, more real. So even in ordinary circumstances, we're embarked on more than ordinary living. Moreover, we have the promise believers shall share the new life more fully hereafter, in splendor and tearless joy, enjoying God's joy and experiencing face to face his love. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain, Paul said, expressing perfectly what resurrection truly means. Lazarus wouldn't have thought what happened to him was diminished, but he must have delighted in how it was surpassed, transcended by the scope of love revealed and available once Christ was risen. My friend will find his expectations greatly exceeded, but so will we all believers. Near the start, I mentioned in passing the Tudor period, and I'm going to end with one of its martyrs' 10 remarkable last words. A 20-year-old Colchester maid, Elizabeth Folkes, facing the flames, managed two short sentences. The first conventional, the second disquieting, till its end makes all lucid. Farewell, all the world. Farewell, faith. Farewell, hope. Welcome, love.